Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Bill Clinton's labor secretary, Robert Reich, warns that America is facing a perfect storm. Too much money is concentrated at the top. The middle class, he says, is getting whittled away. And our politicians, he says, don't have the courage to do anything about it. This hour on Point, Robert Reich warns of American plutocracy, rule by the rich. You can join the conversation. Is inequality the problem? How much is too much? Should government step up and fix it or not? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We'll hear in a bit from Alan Meltzer, former economic advisor to Ronald Reagan. But first, joining me now from Berkeley, California, is Robert Reich, former Secretary of Labor under President Bill Clinton. He's professor of public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. His new book is Aftershock, The Next Economy and America's Future. Robert Reich, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom.
Quoting you right here, you say in the last couple of days, we're losing our democracy to a different system. It's called plutocracy. Make your case.
Well, plutocracy, as we've come to understand the term over the last 100 or so years, is a form of government that is basically run by those who are the wealthiest. And I'm afraid that we're tending in that direction. Not only do we have now hundreds of millions of secret dollars flowing into our midterm elections, but we also have the highest concentration of income and wealth we have had in this country since 1928. The two together, combined with the enormous needs of the average working person in America, needing everything from extended unemployment insurance to, most importantly, a job, to help with homes and helps with savings and help with almost everything that people need right now because the economy is still in the gravitational pull of the Great Recession, to my mind, creates a perfect storm in which money can very easily turn this anxiety, this fear, this trepidation that so many people have into a politics of resentment directed at various groups and people who really have nothing to do with the fundamental problems we have, but deflect attention from what we must do. The fundamental thing we have to do to get the economy going again, as I say in the book, is to make sure that the middle class and the working class, as we used to call it, have enough money in their pockets to turn around and spend. I mean, the crisis right now is really one of what economists call aggregate demand. There is simply not enough spending power in the middle, in the vast middle class, when so much income and wealth have gravitated to the top.
Remind us of the numbers, Bob. What's happened when it comes to the concentration of wealth and income in this country?
Well, it's in 2007, and that's the last year for which we have good data, and this is before, incidentally, the Great Recession, the top 1% got about 23.5% of total national income. The last time we saw that kind of concentration, Tom, was in 1928. Now, we all remember what happened in 1929, and I don't think it's completely coincidental that in 2008, the economy also went into a downturn. I mean, the only way for 30 years that middle-class families could maintain their spending power, even though wages were going nowhere, was by first women going into paid work, and then secondly, everybody working longer hours, and then finally, families using their homes as collateral. As long as those homes were rising in value, that was possible for loans and going deeper and deeper and deeper into debt. But of course, that debt bubble burst, just like it did in 1929. In fact, the parallels are surprisingly strong.
You know, I think a lot of Americans may have come to think that this kind of income distribution is just the way it is in this country. It's been growing in this direction for such a long time now. But in fact, it hasn't. Go back to, I don't know, the mid-70s, that same top 1% only had 8 or 9% of the wealth in the country.
That's right. It's
a fraction of what it is now.
Tom, it's a dramatic U-turn from what it was in the late 1970s. 8 or 9% was the norm in those days for what the top 1% took. of total national income. And then we began seeing concentration from 8 or 9% to 15% in the 1980s to about 17% in the 1990s, and then finally 23.5% in 2007. My expectation, by the way, is that when the new data are in and analyzed, we're going to see even greater concentration because, you see, the middle class has done so badly given where the economy has been over the last 2.5 years, and poverty has increased.
Now, it's funny, we were supposed to be talking today, Robert Reich, with Virginia Thomas, wife of U.S. Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, who has become a big sort of voice, been for a long time on the right, but in this Tea Party era, even more prominent with her Liberty Central movement. But she articulates what a lot in that movement, I mean, she says, you know, plutocracy, she says we're looking at tyranny in the Obama administration. She calls it a tyranny again and again. You say there's a politics of resentment. Yes, indeed there is. But a lot of what we're seeing on television lately is resentment from another direction. You're proposing government get in here and fix this problem. The Tea Party's saying government butt out.
Well, I think that too much of the time we tend to look at just the headlines, which is, do we want bigger or smaller government? And we don't really look at the underlying political and economic structure and the emotions that give rise to it. In the 1930s, Tom, when everybody was worried and panicked, obviously to a greater extent than they are even now, the fear and resentment was channeled by demagogues toward immigrants who became an object of anger and derision, foreign traders. You remember the Smoot-Hawley tariff? That in those days, it was European traders, and also against Jews. Today, if you listen carefully to what the Tea Partiers are angry about, in addition to government, and you listen to talk radio and you listen to the anger that is expressed around America, you hear again immigrants, you hear foreign traders, this time it's China, and you hear Muslims. Now, I'm not saying that there's a direct and inevitable relationship between economic hardship and the power of demagogues to use fear and anxiety to channel it into a politics of resentment, but it's very, very, very much apparent that we have now a very angry politics, and that angry politics begins primarily with the Great Recession. Before the Great Recession, even though we had more, I mean, all the surveys show we had more undocumented workers in the United States then than we do now. We didn't talk as much or as angrily about undocumented workers. Before the Great Recession, even though 9/11 was a much fresher reality for us, we didn't have the virulent debates we are now having about Muslims and the Muslim Center in New York, or even the president and his supposed Muslim connections. And again, China has become so much more of an object of anger since the Great Recession, even though China, although it does have to mend its ways, is not responsible for the loss of 15 million American jobs over the last 2.5 years.
We'll talk about that. Ginny Thomas, Clarence Thomas's wife, bailed out on us today after the news came that of her voicemail to Anita Hill asking her to apologize. But there's a funny relevance here, Robert Reich, because you point in this perfect storm threatening not just the economy, you say, but democracy, to a Supreme Court decision that that he voted in favor of, which was the Citizens United decision, which has put a lot of anonymous money in this plutocratic era, as you call it, into American politics.
I think that Citizens United, Tom, has to be up there with Dred Scott and Bush v. Gore as the three most shameful Supreme Court decisions, grotesque misreadings of the Constitution and also the purpose of the Constitution. It opened the floodgates, and we knew it would. Anybody who read that decision, and I commend to anybody who's listening Justice Stevens' dissent in that decision, which is the most articulate and reasoned and really deft statement of why we need to restrict the money of corporations and indeed anyone into our political process to preserve the First Amendment rights of the rest of us that are being drained away, that are being, in a sense, muffled because there is so much advertising, much of it negative, being financed by the very wealthy and big corporations. But you see, this is part of the perfect storm. If we've got all of this money that is now at the top. We've got people like the Koch brothers, who last year, according to Forbes, increased their net worth by billions of dollars mm-hmm. just in 1 year, a year in which most of us actually saw our net worth decline. The Koch brothers and others are able now to put huge amounts of money into political campaigns, finance the Tea Party, as apparently, according to reports, they are, without any accountability at all, without anybody knowing, without any ability to even trace the money. And that, together with the anger that so many people feel who justifiably are and understandably are angry at the position they find themselves in, given that their homes and their incomes and their wages, their very savings are all now on the line, is a tinderbox. It's a tinderbox for our democracy, and it's a tinderbox with regard to even our economy. You can't really separate the two. And again, in my book, I show how economics and politics are intimately related when it comes to where we're going over the next 5 to 10 to 15 years.
We've just got half a minute before a break, Robert Reich. But if we're, you say, losing our democracy to plutocracy, how do you pull out of that dynamic? Plutocracy comes with political power. How do you turn it around?
Well, I make an argument to, I hope, the richest and most powerful people in this country that they would do better with a smaller share of a rapidly growing economy and one that generates a positive politics than they do with now a very large share of an economy that is almost dead in the water, that is still struggling to get out of the gravitational pull of the Great Recession, and that is breeding a very negative, angry politics.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Bill Clinton's Labor Secretary, Robert Reich, about the U.S. economy, politics, and American democracy. His new book is Aftershock. He's writing very recently, "We're losing our democracy," he says, "to a different system. It's called a plutocracy, concentration of wealth at the top of the economy." He says it's not good for our politics or our economy. He joins us from Berkeley, California. We're going to hear in just a moment from a one-time advisor to President Ronald Reagan, Alan Meltzer, with a different view of what's going on and maybe how to address it. So, Bob Reich, perfect storm, you say, income more concentrated, a relative few Americans buying our democracy as never before, you write. And third, Washington says nothing can be done. There's no money left. You say, on the contrary, you say you'd raise taxes and raise them, I guess, substantially on them that's got. What would you do?
Well, there are a lot of things we can do, Tom. They're not politically viable right now because no politician wants to talk about them. But indeed, no politician even wants to talk about the fact that we have historically almost unprecedented levels of inequality, concentrated income and wealth at the top. But I would start, for example, by exempting the first $20,000 of income from payroll taxes and apply payroll taxes to incomes over, say, $250,000. The benefit there and the benefit of other proposals that I make in the book are that the rich don't spend nearly the same percentage of their income as middle-income people, working-class people, the poor. And therefore, the more that you can rebalance the economy back toward the kind of economy we had in the 1950s, 60s, and early 1970s in terms of who got what, the more likely we are to actually stimulate real spending and get the economy going again. And if we don't do that, we're not going to be able to. Now, I'm not suggesting going back to the marginal tax rates on the rich that we had during the Eisenhower administration. Now, Dwight Eisenhower was not someone who people accused of being a socialist or radical. He was a Republican president, former general. But the marginal tax rates on the very wealthy in the 1950s during the Eisenhower administration were 91%.
Wow.
And for most of that prosperous era, the 30 years after the Second World War, the marginal income tax on the very, very wealthy never went below 70%. Now, we're so far away from that right now that even suggesting we go back to the Clinton marginal income tax of 39% on the very wealthy creates a political firestorm. Right now, Congress is blocked with regard to the question of whether the Bush tax cuts for the wealthy are going to be extended or not. But so you can see how far we've come from from where we were. But you see, the point I want to make is that in those 30 years of high taxes on the very wealthy, the economy performed better. We had more rapid economic growth than we have had since. We rebuilt Japan. We rebuilt Germany. Some people say to me, oh, well, we didn't have any competitors. No, we didn't have competitors. We turned around and spent a huge amount of money rebuilding our competitors and rebuilding Europe so that, in fact, all of us could rise together. The rising tide could lift all boats. We were handicapped, actually, by not having foreign traders in those days. Capital gains. This is another area. Right mm-hmm. now, the capital gains rate is 15%, but we've got the richest Americans in all of America who are now treating their income, and the IRS is allowing them to treat their income at capital gains rates. These are hedge fund managers and private mm-hmm. equity managers. Mm-hmm. Last year, the top 25 hedge fund managers had, on average, an income subject to capital gains rates of $1 billion each.
And paying now, Tom, not 36%, again, but paying 15% on capital gains portion of that.
15%. Well, actually, the average for all of those hedge fund managers was 17%, but because some of their income actually did not qualify for mm-hmm. sure. Capital gains treatment. But even 17% is ridiculous. I mean, when politicians in Washington say we don't have the money for education, for infrastructure, to extend unemployment insurance, to help people with their mortgages, to do what we have to do for our children, for Medicaid and so forth, they are not looking at the reality of what's happened to our tax structure. And what's happened to our tax structure is that essentially the people at the very top have got off, paying less than they almost ever have, in fact, indeed ever have since the end of the Second World War, and they are getting away with it because they are financing so much of our political system, our Democrats as well as Republicans.
Robert Reich's new book is Aftershock. We're going to hear in just a moment from Alan Meltzer. A call or two first. Ray in Buffalo, New York. You're on the air, Ray, with Robert Reich.
Yes, Mr. Reich, I thoroughly agree with your tax assessment, and the 15% capital gain should be mean tested at $100,000 or more. Anything more than that should have an increasing tax rate. Here in Buffalo, tens of thousands of manufacturing jobs have been lost to foreign countries with cheap labor, and it seems to me that the multinational corporations have disinvested themselves in the United States chasing cheap labor overseas. I don't know how you compete with 50 cent an hour labor. And millions of jobs have been taken from the United States, brought over to China, Sri Lanka, wherever, and we no longer have manufacturing jobs in this country. And that was what the middle class was based on, was making things and selling it to somebody else. I don't agree. I think that you cannot compete with 50 cent an hour labor in China. I'd like you to comment on that, please.
Yeah, thanks, Ray. Robert Reich, I mean, a lot of people are wondering if progressives are promoting in some way trade war, or do you think that's necessary to build some kind of
no,
wall?
No, I don't think we need a trade war. Right now, we're on the verge of a currency war because the United States is watching, or in fact, quietly encouraging the dollar downward, while other nations are worried about that, and they are now manipulating their currencies subtly to get their currencies down as well. But my point with Ray is that he's absolutely right in one respect, and that is obviously we've lost huge numbers of manufacturing jobs, but we can't even begin. Ray, we can't even begin to have a constructive debate about what to do about all this because so many of our politicians are taking so much money from global corporations who are actually earning more and more of their money abroad. It's almost amusing that the Democrats are accusing the Chamber of Commerce of the United States of taking secret money from abroad when, in fact, it is particularly – it's entirely legal right now for global corporations who make most of their money abroad to be essentially paying off our own Democrats and Republicans in their campaigns in this midterm election.
So if they weren't, Robert Reich, how might policy be different? If they weren't – if they didn't have that sway, you say you're not looking for protectionism, but if those corporations didn't have that sway, how do you think policy might be different?
Well, for one thing, we could demand that all our trading partners have a minimum wage that was half of their median wage. That, for example, would allow the gains from trade abroad to go to a much, much larger group of people in their nations. That would be good for them in terms of political stability. It would also be good for us in terms of more and more of their people emerging into the middle class and therefore being able to afford our goods. It's not backdoor protectionism because it would mean that they effectively would grow, and as they grew, as they did better and better, their wages would rise accordingly. We could have labor side agreements and environmental side agreements of the sort that some of us tried to get with NAFTA that would further ensure that nations that even were much poorer than us had standards that improved over time as their populations got wealthier, as their nations got wealthier. So that, again, it was not protectionism. It was a matter of a sliding scale, so that we were not always finding ourselves competing with people who were essentially being, I'm going to use the word advisedly, exploited by producers from all over the world.
Let's take one more call, then we'll go to Alan Meltzer. William in Boston, you're on the air, William.
Hi. As a conservative, it's almost painful for me to agree with your guest, but I do in many respects. I agree fully that a strong middle class is absolutely essential, or we could risk, God forbid, even civil unrest at some point in the future. Mm. And I agree that the super rich should be taxed heavier. What I disagree on is the campaign funding, although I agree that lobbyists are pouring way too much money into Congress and maybe should be restricted because, after all, the money is going to definitely control their decision-making process. But as far as individuals, I'm wondering if your guests would agree if these Koch brothers bought, you know, 10 billion signs and put them up all over for a certain candidate. Is that any different from putting money into the system? I don't have a TV. I haven't had one for 20 years. We could ignore the things on the air. We could ignore signs. But is there any difference between money from individuals who are trying to influence a campaign and putting signs up? Let's say somebody has a strong grassroots program that could put...
William, we'll pick it up. Any difference between grassroots political campaigning and the kind of big money campaigning you're bemoaning, Robert Reich?
Well, William does have a good point theoretically, but actually television is overwhelmingly important. If we had a requirement under the FCC, Federal Communications Commission, that any cable or any broadcaster would have to provide free advertising to candidates who met certain minimal standards of being candidates, that would be one thing. But right now we are seeing huge, unbelievable amounts of money, and again, it's logarithmically. Every election it goes up another 20% or 30% or 100% money going into advertising, often negative advertising, that has very effective results. But now it's secret. I mean, not only are we seeing more and more money going in, and much of this coming from very wealthy people and corporations, but now, after Citizens United, we are in a position where we don't even know who is doing what. The Disclose Act, which Congress considered a few months ago and was passed by the House, was blocked by Republicans in the Senate. That would have required that all advertisers reveal exactly who sponsored the ads. And that, to me, William, is the least we can ask.
But every single Republican in the Senate voted against that.
Yes, every Republican in the Senate voted against it. And interestingly, Tom, compared to 10 years ago, I mean, there was a similar campaign finance bill under obviously different conditions and different stipulations 10 years ago in which a lot of Republicans came along. So we have a Republican Party that has become much more disciplined and united against any kind of disclosure of who is financing whom, and that makes me a little bit nervous because perhaps a lot of those Republicans know that a lot of this new secret money is going into Republican campaigns and Tea Party campaigns supporting Republicans.
Robert Reich is with us. His new book is Aftershock. Joining us from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is Professor of Political Economy at Carnegie Mellon Tepper School of Business, Alan Meltzer. He served on the Council of Economic Advisors to President Ronald Reagan. He's been a consultant to Congress, U.S. Treasury, Federal Reserve, World Bank. Alan Meltzer, thanks very much for being here.
Nice to be with you.
You hear Robert Reich's argument. Inequality is throwing everything out of whack. We need to take active steps to fix it for the democracy and the economy. What do you say?
Well, I think it's very interesting to see how an intelligent man and a highly articulate defender of his point of view can be so wrong. The fact is that we have the Tea Party. If there's ever a middle-class group out there protesting, it's the Tea Party. The enthusiasm of the Tea Party activists and the Republicans in this election is enormous. Why? It's overwhelming. That's why they think they're going to win the election. It's because the middle class is protesting. This is a middle class objection to the redistribution of income.
What redistribution of income?
Like to do more redistribution, and that's certainly a view that is shared by many people, but it isn't the view that's shared by the majority. So we have a middle class revolt.
Alan Meltzer, hasn't income been redistributed up quite dramatically? Isn't that the redistribution we've seen?
We have seen two Swedish economists looked at redistribution at the income share of the largest 10%, the highest 10% since 1900. And it's very interesting. There's been an enormous drop from 1900 to 1950, before the welfare state, mostly because income from capital, from assets, came down. After that, it bounces around. It goes up, it goes down. At the present time, the share of the wealthiest has gone up. Now, we want to ask not just is that a bad thing or a good thing, but we first want to ask, why did that happen? And the answer is because we have big technological changes in all the seven countries that the Swedish economists looked at. And incidentally, the lines are very parallel. They move up and down pretty much together. And they've moved up now in Sweden, in England, in Germany, in Australia.
You mean the lines of inequality, Alan?
Uh-huh. Why is that? Because we have a technological change which puts a premium on education. And our education system is failing. It's a state-run monopoly in most places, and it doesn't do its job. And everyone recognizes that, but and has recognized that since at least the 1970s when we had a public report called A Nation at Risk. But we haven't been able to get through the teachers' union's monopoly, the other kinds of problems that prevent us from educating and changing the income distribution that way. That's the way, you know, the United States imported hundreds of millions of people. Their children went to school, the parents worked, the children moved into the middle class. They did it through education.
But not happening now, you're saying. I want to hear more of that, but Robert Reich, just before the break, I mean, there's sort of the view that, you know, those who don't have much are getting what they deserve given their crummy government education.
I'd like to make a second point.
Well, I'll go to that, Alan, right after a break, but just a quick response before we do that. Bob Reich?
Well, let me first of all say I have enormous respect for Professor Meltzer, and I agree with him that behind much of this widening inequality is technology as well as globalization and a failing educational system. But I'd like to go deeper and ask, why is the educational system failing? Why is it that over the last 30 years, as opposed to the 30 years before that, we have failed to, for example, provide enough funding for public higher education? Why we've deregulated? Why we've privatized? Why we've fought unions? Why we have a marginal tax rate that is so much lower than we had in the first three decades after the Second World War? You see, I think that we have not responded to the forces that Alan Meltzer has identified, technology and globalization. We've, in fact, allowed them to widen the gap between the rich and everybody else.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Bill Clinton's Labor Secretary, Robert Reich, about the U.S. economy, politics, and American democracy. He says it's in trouble. We're headed for plutocracy. His new book is Aftershock. We're also joined from Pittsburgh by Alan Meltzer, served on the Council of Economic Advisors under President Reagan. He says Robert Reich is a smart guy, But he's got it wrong. The whole structure is changing here, and that's the issue. Alan, Bob, lots of comment here online. Nikki says, inequality is a problem by itself. What really matters most, however, is the timidity of politicians who profess caring about regular folks. And she says, the other problem is the limitless passivity of the populace. That's from Nikki. Alan Meltzer says, "What are you kidding me? Passivity? Look at the Tea Party." Got another from Kellen here, who says, who may be in that camp. She says, sounds like a whole lot like distribution of wealth. The Constitution guarantees us an equal opportunity, not an equal outcome. We have the right to prosper and keep the fruits of our labor. This was central to the Founding Fathers' vision. We need to get back to that vision. I say, she writes, no to distribution of wealth. And finally, Carl on Facebook says, it already is a plutocracy. If you aren't wealthy or at least have connections to the wealthy, you have no chance of living even a comfortable life anymore. Kristen in Charlotte, North Carolina. Kristen, what do you think?
I have to agree with that last comment, Tom. I think we're already there. I think the rich and powerful are already in control, and that the rest of us aren't represented and aren't going to be represented.
Alan Meltzer says, come on, look in the streets. The Tea Party's, making a lot of noise, and those are American people.
And middle-class people.
What do you say, Kirsten?
I think they are American people, and I think they are making a lot of noise, but I don't think they're a majority. And I think that, the extremist views that they have in a lot of ways are not representative of American mainstream, and the cries for small government rings very false to me, because I believe these are the same people that supported President Bush wholeheartedly, and he grew the government limitlessly.
Kristen, I appreciate your call. I guess we'll find out, at least in terms of who's voting, where the majority comes down very soon here in the midterm elections. Alan, Robert Reich says, you're right. There have been changes in technology and other sort of structural elements here that have helped bring us to this point. But he's saying, why hasn't anything been done about it?
Well, there's been an enormous amount done about it. People are objecting to what's being done about it. We've piled up a debt, which is unsustainable, that we have to do something about. We have to do something about the educational system, but we have a hard time. But look, it isn't just the rich giving money to the Tea Party or the Republicans. There's a man named George Soros who gives tons of money to MoveOn.org. Wall Street in the 2008 election largely supported the Obama program. People divide in different ways. Universities, those are high-paid professionals. Most of them, I'm sure Robert Reich will agree, most of his colleagues are Democrats, favor more redistribution. So it isn't quite as much a plutocracy as he says.
But that's different from what they favor. That's different.
In every election, there's a fight between those who favor more redistribution and those who favor more growth.
Do you not think inequality is a problem? Do you think it's fine, Professor Meltzer?
To the people, look, when people say how terrible things are, we have to remember that the per capita income in the United States, the median income in the United States, is around $54,000 a year. By any standard that the world has ever seen, that's quite high.
What about the influence that comes with all the money that is just in the numbers,
it's
concentrated?
I mean, George Soros and many of those people in the MoveOn organization give to left-wing groups that want more redistribution, that want to stop our involvement in other countries, and so on. I mean, the left consists to a very considerable extent of people who pay for the programs that Mr. Obama ran, and Wall Street supported him. And it just isn't true that all of the people who are giving the money. Second, you can complain about the Koch brothers and all that, but they're not holding a gun to those people out in the street. Those people are out there protesting because they don't like what they see. And what they see is massive debts that are going to hurt their children, that are going to have to be paid for by their children and grandchildren.
Robert Reich, what do you say to the Tea Party argument Alan Meltzer makes here, the everybody's giving argument? You've heard it all.
Well, I think, again, Alan Meltzer has a kernel of truth there, but he surrounds it by a lot of misinformation. For example, yes, George Soros did and has contributed mightily, but he did it in the open. We knew who he was. We had full disclosure. Right now, the Republicans will not even allow full disclosure. We don't even know who's financing whom. We have some scattered information that people like the Koch brothers are financing Republicans. We know that Republicans are likely to be the recipients of a lot of this secret money because they're voting against disclosure, but we just simply don't know. The other point I think it's important to make is that the classic right versus left debate, I argue, is irrelevant and increasingly irrelevant, even though Alan Meltzer wants to put it back there. He says that the debate is fundamentally between redistribution and growth. My point is that we cannot have real growth again until we have an economy in which there's more widely shared prosperity, as we did in the 30 years after the Second World War. Growth was much more rapid then than it has been since. And the only reason that middle-class families after the late 1970s were able to continue to spend is because women went into the paid workforce and everybody worked harder and everybody borrowed like mad. But we can't do that any longer. And therefore, the hollowing out of the middle class and the working class really is hurting our prospects for growth.
But Alan Meltzer comes back to government involvement.
Alan, let me just finish my thought, please,
if I can.
Because you did have a
wonderful... No, Alan, one second. I just wanted to ask you, Robert Reich, if I could, because he points back and says, well, yes, but in effect he's arguing that Americans aren't well educated enough to merit higher incomes than what they've got.
Yes, but why is it that we don't have early childhood education? Why is it that we are laying off teachers? Why is it that we are strangling our systems of public higher education, increasing fees? The state governments are broke. They are now pulling the plug on public education. They've been doing it for years, but they're doing it even more dramatically now. And the reason that they can't do anything other than that is the federal government can't backstop them. The federal government, and a lot of Republicans say the federal government is simply too far in debt to invest in education. Well, if there's any responsibility, it seems to me, that we have as a country to the future, it's to provide a good education to our children and also to repair our infrastructure that is suffering from years of deferred maintenance. Why can't we do this? Are we really broke? Of course we're not. In fact, if you look at the hedge fund managers and the private equity managers, the Wall Street traders, the extent, the fact that CEOs are now earning an unprecedented 350 times what average workers are earning, when 30 years ago they were earning 50 times what their average workers were earning. We have money. It's just that we don't have the political will to do what we need to do, and that is to raise marginal income taxes on the top, make sure that our capital gains rate is applied appropriately so that hedge fund managers and other private equity managers don't pay capital gains of 15% on income that is actually truly income and should be taxed as income. And we do other things, such as I have suggested in my book. We can grow again, if the middle class and the working class have the wherewithal. We can invest in education and infrastructure. We are not a poor country. But Alan Meltzer wants to create this false dichotomy between redistribution and growth, which is no longer relevant.
Alan Meltzer, if we don't do something, aren't we in trouble here?
Well, I agree that we need better education. Everyone seems to agree on that. And I agree that the infrastructure of the United States has been allowed to run down. But I think Robert Reich overlooks the fact that the experiment that he wants of higher tax rates and more redistribution has been run. The Europeans, most of the European countries, France is a good example. Unemployment for the last decade or more has averaged 8%. The growth rates there are way below the U.S. growth rate on average over those years. So that what we're doing is we're taxing the future in order to give to the present. Second, redistribution doesn't work the way he describes it. We don't help the poor. Most of the programs that the government spends on go to the middle class. They go for health care, a middle-class program. Education, a middle-class program. It's very difficult for governments to redistribute money to the lower-income groups, and the reason is because the votes are in the middle class. And we're seeing a wonderful example of those protests now. The people out in the streets are saying, we want less redistribution. We want to worry about, we're not a rich country. We can tax all the hedge fund money in the away.
But you said we are a rich country, Alan.
We are a rich country, but we are not a future rich country because we have an enormous debt that we have to pay, and the only way we're going to pay it is by cutting back heavily on some of the programs we have promised. In his own state of California, where is that money going? It's going to the pensions for people who are making and pensions of $100,000 a year or more. I mean, the unions have rigged the system in California, in New York, in New Jersey, to the point where it's not going to poor people and to help the underprivileged. It's going to pay teachers, firemen, so on. Education, budgets have increased over the last 10, 20 years enormously. Every president has come out with more money for education. Have we gotten better education? Very little.
Alan Meltzer, stand by. And Robert Reich, I'll come to you. A call or two first. Angie, Columbia, South Carolina. Angie, you're on the air.
Hi. I just had a quick comment. I'm from small town USA, and I just wanted to say that the Tea Party movement is a grassroots movement of middle class Americans who are tired of being taxed to try to fund all of the entitlement programs that are out there. I think that's part of the problem. I don't see the problem as being that the upper crust are too rich. I think that there is a sector of our society that feels that they are entitled, and I'll take my comment off the air.
Angie, I appreciate your call. One more right here from Lowell, Massachusetts. Stephanie, you're on.
Hi. To me, it seems fairly obvious that Alan has a very narrow point of view, and it's easy to blame education, but I mean, I know people who, you know, dropped out of school in third grade 50, 60 years ago and went to work and made a living and lived middle class. And Robert's position seems to be fairly, you know, common sense. If people are desperate, their backs are against the wall, they're going to start looking for political solutions like the Tea Parties. I mean, take a look at the Germans in the 20s and the 30s. I mean, they were really in desperate situations, and that's what contributed to the rise of Hitler. I mean, people look for answers there they would normally not look for answers, as, you know, I think Robert made that point earlier. But I don't know. I'd like to know what the level of education of the average Tea Partier is. I'm sorry. Maybe I'm from liberal Massachusetts, but to me it's pretty obvious what the problems are, and that is we have let taxes get skewed.
Stephanie, we've got the concern and the perspective. Bob Reich, here's one question from online. Josh says, what would Robert Reich suggest we do to defuse the Tea Party? He calls it time bomb, or at least broaden the appeal of cooperation that might serve to lead America in a humane direction once again. Robert Reich.
Well, the first stage would be a more equitable and a reasonable tax code that did expand the circle of prosperity and returned the United States to the level and the type of broad-based and shared prosperity we had from 1947 to 1975.
But would that defuse Tea Party anger here? Alan Meltzer represents it just the other way around. He says we're going to have a revolt if we go that
look
way.
I think that if people have more money in their pockets and we're not worried about their mortgages and their wages and their jobs, a lot of the anger would be diffused. I think a lot of the anger is out there because people are feeling completely powerless. And Alan Meltzer says we don't want to go to Europe and become Europeanized. But we don't have to look to Europe as our model. We can look to the United States between 1947 and 1975, when our highest marginal income tax rate was 91% on the highest incomes, when 30% of Americans were unionized, and therefore the middle class and the working class had real bargaining leverage in terms of getting good wages, when we had a regulation of Wall Street, Glass-Steagall Act and other regulations that prohibited Wall Street from taking over the rest of essentially the rest of our economy. Just one more point here, and that is Alan Meltzer and others say, the middle class is fine. The middle class is not fine. In fact, many of the people who are protesting are people whose mortgages are right now underwater and who are afraid of losing their homes. What we ought to be demanding of Wall Street is that they allow people to use personal bankruptcy and include their primary residence in personal bankruptcy, which is something that Wall Street has absolutely forced Congress to turn its back on, in essentially, and refuse to do. But that would give homeowners more bargaining leverage with bankers and with lenders. There are many things we can do, Tom. The problem is we don't now have a political system that is in the control of the middle class and the working class. It is more and more of a plutocracy. And for anybody to fail to see that, it seems to me, is just to engage in illusion. We have got to take our government back. We've got to take our democracy back. And I think that the worst form of reaction to all of this would be cynicism. If people just listen to what I'm saying or read my book or listen to
I don't think Alan Meltzer is cynical, but I want to give him one more word, Alan.
We can do.
Where do you think the politics of this are going on November 2nd, Alan?
I think we're going to stalemate. That is, we're going to have one party that says, look, we worry a lot about the future. We worry about our children who are going to have these enormous debts that are unsustainable. We worry about the problem that the economy, that the present administration has done very little. It's wasted an enormous amount of stimulus, and we want to correct that. Right. And that they've adopted a health care program which is unpopular.
Well, there were out of time, I'm afraid. Alan Meltzer at the Carnegie Mellon, thank you so much for being with us. And Robert Reich, author of Aftershock, thank you for joining us. Listeners, same to you. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.